Throughout the ages, God has placed his people in many different locations and also in very different positions in society. In the palace of Shushan, God had placed Queen Esther to ensure that the Jews were preserved in the Persian Empire. When the armies of Saul were afraid of Goliath, God placed a shepherd boy in their midst who honored God and destroyed Goliath. When Pharaoh was troubled by his dreams, God had Joseph come into his midst to interpret them and to preserve Joseph's own family from famine. God still places his people in all walks of life. Today, I'm speaking with Gary Raymond, who is a retired chief inspector of the New South Wales Police. Whilst Gary was in the police force in Australia, he joined the police rescue squad, where he was involved in 1,500 rescues. One of the major rescue scenes that Gary attended was the Granville train disaster, which happened on the 8th of January 1977. It was the worst rail disaster in Australian history. Locomotive 4620, with 8 passenger carriages, had set off early in the morning from Mount Victoria in the Blue Mountains, and its destination was Sydney. The train derailed at Granville, a Sydney suburb, and ploughed into the supports of an overhead bridge, bringing the bridge down on some of the passenger carriages. Gary Raymond was called to the scene. Gary, when did you first hear about the accident at Granville?
I started my day's duty. It was on Tuesday, the 18th of January, 1977. We'd arrived around 10 to 8 or somewhere around there. And then around about 10 past 8, we went into our meal room and had a cup of coffee and just catch up with those on shift with the squad. And around about 8:15, our emergency alarm went off, which is what happened. The alarm would go off. We'd then go to our vehicles and call police dispatch, and they would tell us what the rescue was. So we ran to our police vehicles and thinking, oh, we've got a road crash in the morning, or, you know, maybe sadly and regrettably found a body at the bottom of the gap or somewhere. So we got in the vehicle and the dispatcher said, the police rescue is required that a train is stuck under a bridge. Now, that was interesting because I was in the big 10-ton rescue truck, the heavy rescue vehicle, with the late Sergeant Bill Fay. And we sort of had a discussion about, oh, it must have been a goods train that had a high load and got stuck under the bridge at Bold Street at Granville. And so we thought, oh, well, we'd be assisting the railway crews to lower the load so the train could continue. So we just started to drive out of there normally towards Granville. On the way, the first police car arrived and he called on the radio and said, the bridge has come down on a passenger train and I've got people injured. And we looked at each other. We thought, wow, this is different. So then we activated the lights and sirens. And I'll tell you what I remember distinctly, that every 30 seconds or so as police arrived or police had a look at the scene, a police car would call in and say, oh, we've got 2 people injured. Then another one would call in, I think we've got 4 people. And each 30 seconds, the number kept rising. And then it got to the point where they'd say, we don't know how many are injured, but there's a lot injured and we believe a lot killed. And so we sort of looked at each other and I thought, wow, this is big. So we arrived on the northern side of the Bold Street Bridge. That's on the Parramatta Road side. And Granville too is a sort of a western suburb of Sydney in New South Wales, Australia. And when we pulled up, we got out of the vehicle and we came to the edge of where the bridge had collapsed and caused like a culvert. And we looked down and we saw in and around the train that we could sort of see, we know now there was 213 people injured. Some were wandering around with blood on their face and, you know, coming from head wounds and other wounds. Some were just crying. Some were just sitting there staring into space. And Sergeant Fay looked at me and said, Gaz, said, yes, Sarge. He said, don't worry about them, pointing to all the injured people. And he said, the AMBOs, you know, the paramedics, in other words, the nurses and doctors will look after them. And he said, you get down there and get in under that bridge into those carriages and tell me what we've got. Now, those with emergency services or military background know that that simply is do a reconnaissance. What is it we've got? How many injured? How many killed? What are the entrapment mechanisms? Any dangers? Any risks? And so I tied a rope and climbed down the railway culvert onto the tracks and went down. It's interesting, on the way, there was a firefighter who'd arrived, a young fireman, and he was squatting next to a lady who was screaming and crying. And I stopped and I said, "Hey, mate." And he said, "Yes, senior." I said, "Don't worry about her. She's fine. That fellow over there, he's on his back unconscious." I said, "You need to carefully, keeping his spine straight, log roll him onto his side in case he compromises his airway with vomit or anything else," which was interesting. And that's called triage. It's a French word meaning sorting of casualties. And you're taught from day one, myself as an ambulance officer was taught, and then as police rescue, that we sort the casualties out, which is the worst and which is the least. And then you put them into categories and for the, I guess, the emergency of their treatment. So I came onto the northern side where the bridge was down on top of the train, and I had to bend over to get under the bridge, and it sort of brought you beside the crushed carriages. So as I turned to my left and looked into the crushed carriages, keep in mind the floor of the train to the roof of the train where the bridge was just roughly just under a metre, you know, or, you know, 5 foot or so in feet terms, and could have been less, even 4 foot in some places. And there I saw many people crushed forward in their seats and obviously were beyond life. There was nothing we could do. They had died.
So you're saying that the train was only a metre high in parts as it had been crushed. Is that right?
That's right, yes. So that was an extremely confined space. There was still a bit of dust in the air, and there was the smell of sort of grease and timber, and because the train roof was plywood. Now, plywood is thin sheets of wood glued together, and these were glued together by tar. Now, later on, when we had to cut that, it was quite difficult to cut because you couldn't use, like mechanical cutting, because it would heat the tar up and stick the blades. And so we had to cut it by hand and then every now and then stop to let the blade cool down so it wouldn't melt the tar. And so there I was going further down under the bridge and looking into the carriages for a place I could get in. So I saw part of the carriage was burst open onto the ground. And so I was able to climb up that carriage side and get into the carriage itself. Now, just coming back a little bit, to give people an idea, the train was coming from the mountains, as you mentioned, and it came onto the bend after leaving Parramatta towards Granville, and the train was doing the right speed. Later on, we found the pantograph, that is the sort of the graph from the little black box, if you like, and the train was doing exactly the right speed. As it came round, it derailed. It left the rails. It jumped off the rails and fell on its side, its right side. Carriage one, it sort of knocked out the stanchions of the bridge supports. And as carriage one went through, the stanchions, like a knife, cut through carriage one. Many were killed there and injured. But they weren't trapped because it was all burst open like a matchbox. Carriage two slipped under the bridge without a scratch. But then when the train derailed and came to a halt, the bridge, because its supports had been knocked out, was just balancing very precariously on only 1 foot of brick course each side. And then suddenly about 30-odd seconds later, after the derailment, the bridge cracked, broke its back, and came squarely down onto carriages 3 and 4. So that's where I was crawling underneath next to. The next thing that I noticed was a smell. And I thought, what's that smell? And I'm, you know, sniffing it. And I thought, what? I don't believe it. The smell was LPG, liquid petroleum gas. And I thought, where's that? We must have severed. Somehow the train severed a gas line. Or there's, I don't know what the source of it, but liquid petroleum gas, if you get the right air-gas mixture and then have an ignition, like a spark or a flame or a decent red heat of any kind, it can set it off to the most horrific explosion you've ever seen in your life. They call it a blevy. It's sort of that liquid expanding explosion. It just, and if it would have gone off, it would have killed everybody that was alive under there, including us. I found out later that the train, rightfully so, carried liquid petroleum gas cylinders, big ones, in locked cupboards at the end of each carriage. And they were designed, because the train came from the Blue Mountains, in winter they'd preheat the carriages with gas heaters, which was nice and comfortable for the commuters. But when the bridge came down and crushed the carriage, it crushed the cylinders, bursting them open. And we were getting this liquid petroleum gas leaking underneath the bridge in the train area. And with that, I screamed out, don't anyone light up anything or start a motor. We've got LPG here. A few of the rescue guys from the Nepean Volunteer Rescue Squad had arrived, and one of them was overcome by the gas, and they had to extricate him and treat him with the ambulance officers. And so we did a couple of things. Firstly, our mates from the fire brigade had a foam generator. Now, that's a big fan, a huge fan, but it doesn't run on a motor, because a motor would have created a spark. It runs on water. You put the hose on top of the fan, and when the water rushes through the blades, it turns it. And we're able then to extract the remaining gas out of there. Now, during this time that they were getting rid of the gas, I knew I couldn't use any of my motorised equipment or anything that may have caused a spark, because that would have killed us and a whole range of other people. But I came across a lady while I was underneath there, and she was struggling to breathe. She'd been crushed forward between two seats, and she was battling to breathe. So in police rescue, we always carried a pocket knife day and night in our overalls pocket, because you never know when you're going to use a pocket knife. So I pulled my pocket knife out, and I slit the seat open down the side, and I pulled all the stuffing out of the seat, which then flattened the seat. And I did the same with the one in front of her and the one at the back of her. That gave her about 4 or 5 inches of space to start breathing normally again. And so as I was crawling through, an ambulance officer came in, and his name's Brian, and he joined us. And by the way, just coming back, it's interesting, when I first got into the train, I noticed a fellow there with a blue singlet, blue shorts, and he was had thongs on, the good old thongs. He was covered in tattoos, I mean, from head to toe. But I noticed the tattoos weren't the ones you get at the tattoo parlour down the road, you know, like the ones you pay for, the artistic ones.
Yep.
These were ones that I knew were done in jail, because they take on a very unprofessional character, and often there's, you know, hate and stuff in their tattoos from jail. And he was clearing debris. He was getting bits of timber and bits of this and that and clearing away. And I looked down at his tattoos, and he saw me looking at his tattoos, and he said, "Yeah, copper," he said, "another time, another place, we'd be in fisticuffs." He said, "But I want to give you a hand here, copper." And I just tapped him on the shoulder and said, "Good on you, mate, let's do this." And we're actually tunneling in to, you know, clearing debris to get into the people who were trapped in the carriages. And I often thought of that, you know, here's the cop and the crim working together for a common cause, that is to save people's lives. And we sort of almost put aside who we were at that time to perform that task. And you know what it reminded me of today? It reminds me that Jesus actually put aside who he was. He was still purely and utterly God and utterly man, God the Son, but he put aside his time in heaven to come to earth, in Jesus, of course, and literally to save us, to pay the penalty for our sins. So he put aside the comfort, the joy, the fellowship of heaven and his Father and the Holy Spirit to come down into the cesspool of sin and unrighteousness, then to, you know, put his life on that cross to pay the penalty and take God's wrath that should have been on us on himself. And so I often think of now we can be reconciled to God through Christ. And, you know, here's me really with this criminal being reconciled with him for that time while we worked together. But so finally, a lot of ambulance officers and police rescue came into where we were, and he had to leave. And I don't know where he is today, but I'd love to meet up with him today somewhere sometime to thank him for his effort that day, despite him not liking coppers. And so I was joined by an ambulance officer, and we worked out that as we were crawling through the carriages, coming in from the side of the carriage and coming out, going back in and crawling through between people who had lost their lives. So I was actually crawling above and below and beside people who were obviously very much dead, sadly, to find people who are alive. And that's like a reconnaissance, as I mentioned. The ambulance officer and I worked out a little system of thumbs up, I've found someone alive, or thumbs down, this person sadly is gone. They're dead. And we're crawling through the first carriage there, coach three, and towards the end of the carriage, when the bridge came down, it had pushed the back or end wall of the carriage inwards. And as we were crawling through, I saw a very confined space, and there was a young lady in there. She was 19, blonde, very tall, and she was literally had been squashed down and pushed forward into a circle where her face was literally on a chest and her legs were up. It was tighter than the fetal position. My ambulance mate put his thumbs down, said she's gone. Now, as I crawled past her straight away, in police rescue, we're always taught to double check or even triple check. Like, for example, if I was going over a cliff, my mates in police rescue would check very carefully all of my knots, my harness, make sure my hard hat was secured and properly fitted. All of these things we would double and sometimes triple check. They've, you know, two or three check you. I put my hand in onto her neck beside her Adam's apple to feel for a carotid pulse. And I got the shock of my life. I felt the carotid pulse very rapid. And I turned around to him and I put my thumbs up vigorously and said, shook my head and said, "And yes, she's alive." He said, "What?" And I said, "Yeah." But what had happened was, just before we'd reached her, she'd actually stopped breathing because her airway has been very badly obstructed and couldn't get enough tidal volume past the obstruction of air. And so I knew without any delay at all what I had to do. And I reached into that very, very small space, got her head, and I sort of turned it to the side, which I was worried about because I didn't know whether she had a cervical spine and neck injury at all, but I had to, otherwise she was literally dying in front of me. And so I got ahead and I rotated it, and then I lifted her jaw upwards and forwards to get that massive tongue muscle off her airway. And just pausing there for a minute, Vince, a lot of people say to me, oh, Gary, in police rescue or an ambulance officer before that, you must have seen some pretty horrible things. You know, you must have seen some awful things. Well, yeah, that's right. We did on some occasions see some very challenging sights. But, you know, Vince, no one has ever said to me in the ambulance or police rescue, what about the smells of rescue? What about the sounds of rescue or the silences of rescue? Where there should be sounds, there's silence because some beautiful soul has lost their life. And what about the things you touch or the things that touch you? Now, the sight, sound, smells and touches and silences are all to do with what we call a sensory stimuli. Well, you know what? When I opened Debbie's airway, doing that manoeuvre with a head and a jaw, I heard one of the most beautiful sounds that I've ever heard in my life. And suddenly it was, Debbie was breathing spontaneously on her own. Now, thank God for that, because I could not have got in there to this space to give her mouth-to-mouth, mouth-to-mouth resuscitation to get her breathing. Her colour got better and she started moaning. And as I held her there, she said, what happened? Did a plane crash the train? She thought an aeroplane had come in and crashed on top of it. And I said, no, a bridge came down. What's your name? She said, Debbie. And I said, Debbie, just stay really still, because very soon I want to put a collar on your neck just to keep your neck stable, just in case. Have you got a sore neck? She said, yes. And she, her eyes were sort of looking around, confused. And she said, who are you? And I said, I'm Gary, and I'm with Police Rescue. And I said this to her, Vince, I said, now that I've reached you, you and I will be leaving this together. I will bring you out. And that was like a promise I made to her, and that reassured her a great deal that, that I was going to get her out. Now, not long after that, the boss of the rescue squad, the late Sergeant Joe Beecroft, lovely Christian too, he came crawling in and he sort of, you know, with his finger timing it, moved towards him. We're still in this very confined space, so I moved towards him and he whispered. He said, the bridge is moving. It may collapse on you. You need to leave now. Each one of you need to leave. That's myself and the, you know, police rescue and ambulance. And I whispered back, I said, Joe, I can't leave these people. I've told them I'm going to get them out and I will get them out. And I said, what if I get down a lot lower? I'll stay really low. If the bridge shifts and comes down, I'll be between the girders and I'll be right. And he said, no. He said, get out of here. I said, I don't want to. Suddenly the mood changed. Not Gary and Joe anymore. Constable, I order you, I direct you to get out of, from under this bridge now. And I looked at him and I said, yes, Sergeant. And it's interesting, in the military, in the police force, if you disobey a lawful direction by a senior officer, you can actually be charged with and get in a bit of bother. To disobey a reasonable direction means an insubordinance and, you know, it's a, well, it's a disgrace, really, and neglect of duty in some ways. So I whispered into Debbie's ear. I said, I've got to go, and I'll be back. And that was the hardest thing that I had to do, was to crawl backwards out of there and leave her in this space. It was just really, really difficult. And by the way, I forgot to mention that when I opened her airway and she started breathing by herself and the colour got better, and I did a what we call a tip of the head to the tip of the toes medical examination of her, and discovered that one of her legs was partially amputated. due to the crushing of the bits of the carriage that came in when the bridge came down. And so while I was holding her airway open, I had to make sure that I stopped the bleeding. But it was amazing, because she was squashed in this small space, the blood vessels had been occluded, that is, sort of bent and blocked. And so I reached in and it took me a while to get it on, but I put a tourniquet on and marked the time on the tourniquet, because you can't leave them on for too long, although the leg was certainly not in a place where it could have been reattached, but it was certainly very badly torn. So I then left Debbie. I had a little pen torch. The gas was all gone by this. And I said to her, I said, here, I'm going to leave my torch with you, pardon me, and when I'll be back, I'll follow where the light of the torch is and I'll find you quickly. So I had to leave. Well, as the engineers and railway workers and others were stabilising the bridge using some timber cribbing, you know, like piles of timber crisscross to hold the bridge where it was, I was pacing up and down, up and down, up and down. I was like so anxious to get back in there to these people who are now alone in this dark, smelly, confined space. It was bad enough being trapped there, but to be your rescuers to leave, I couldn't imagine it, because I'd never, ever, in my entire time in police rescue, ever left anyone trapped or injured. Never. It's just not in our vocabulary, it's not in our training, it's not in our mindset to ever leave anyone. So finally a whistle was blown and they said, safe to go back in. Well, I was like a rat up a drain pipe. I crawled back in beside the carriages, then crawled into the carriage again on my tummy, crawling through again between those who have lost their lives. And in the distance, I saw my torchlight. And so as I was scurrying through the small spaces, I just followed the light. And when I reached Debbie, there was my torch still on. And, you know, that reminded me too that we hear in the Bible that Jesus is the light of the world. And if we follow him in the darkness, then we'll certainly not only have eternal life when we die or when he returns, in fact, day-to-day life, if we follow the light, follow him, will be absolutely and utterly safe and will achieve that wonderful glory. And so when I reached her, I said, I'm back again. You know what she said? Like staggering to talk, but she said, I knew you'd be back. And you know what that reminds me of? That reminds me that Jesus left, he ascended, and after he was crucified and rose from the dead, he was on earth for a fairly long period of time, mixing with people, and then he ascended into heaven, and with the promise that he would be back. And it says there, in the same manner in which he left, he'll be back. And so I thought, you know, when she said, I knew you'd be back, I want people to realize that Jesus will return. If he said, I'll be back, he's never, ever told a lie or misled us, ever, in his word, never. And so when he says, I will be back, I am returning, you can be sure that is going to happen, that will happen. And so we worked on her and we worked on a number of other people there who are alive. Now, I don't know if people have heard of the crush syndrome. Have you heard of that, Vince?
Yes, I have.
Yeah. It's just to explain to people where people are compressed, particularly the legs. The leg muscles get compressed, flattened, in other words. And during that time, the little cells in the muscles burst open and releases a lot of electrolytes and other chemicals that don't belong in the circulation. They belong inside the cells, and so all these toxins, if you like, to the body are leaking out, and if we release the pressure too soon, then bleeding occurs in the crushed area, plus all these toxic chemicals from from inside the cells, inside the muscle tissue, burst open and get caught up in the circulation. They can go to the heart, and the potassium and other chemistry can cause a heart attack in a young person. It upsets the electrical pathways in the heart. And there's other big, huge protein molecules called myoglobin. And it's this protein can get into the circulation after it released the crush, and it clogs up the kidneys because they won't go through the kidney filters. So the person can get very severe renal failure, kidney failure. So we couldn't release Debbie and many of the others suddenly. We had to do it over time and have our medical teams, our doctors, nurses, and ambos to stabilize the person before we release them. So 10 hours later, I was under the air for 10 hours straight, and people were giving us some water, but I had to tip the water in, you know, like roll over, pull my cheek open, and tip the water into my cheek to drink it. At a couple of stages, I wanted to urinate, wanted to have a wee, and what I had to do was sort of turn on my side and wee down a crack in the carriage floor, because it was a fairly lengthy time and effort to get out of the confined spaces we're actually in. It was like a cave. You can imagine the time it takes to get in and out of a cave. So we're working very, very carefully on Debbie and another young lady called Erica Watson. And she was a ballerina, and a number of other people we're all working on. Well, finally, after that 10 hours of being in there, we're ready to release Debbie. And it was very, very good because we cleared the debris around her and we could straighten her body out and splint some, you know, different injuries and bandage her up properly and all of those, you know, put drips in her to maintain the fluid. And finally, Debbie was one of the last. Brian Gordon was the last man out, but Debbie was just before Brian. And she was taken urgently to hospital for a whole range of operations. Now, coming back a little bit, just before we got her out, Debbie said to me, Gary, I said, yes, Debbie, what is it? She said, down on my lower pelvis, the pain is getting worse. And I said, okay. So I palpated her abdomen and the abdominal muscles were hard as a rock. Now, for those who aren't medically trained, the abdominal muscles often get very hard and protect the abdomen when there's something happening inside the abdomen, such as a bleed or air in there or an infection or whatever. And so I knew when I palpated her abdomen that it was hard as a rock. There was something going on there. And I said to her, Deb, just keep really still. I'll tell the doctor about this and they'll look after that. You know what she said? She said to me, I know where this pain's coming from. She said, do you think I'll ever get married and have a child? I mean, that was quite a startling shock for me, a question like that. I've never been asked in a rescue situation before.
Yeah.
And I just turned and I said these words. I said, Debbie, only God knows. Now, I just want to pause there. It's interesting that I learned from my Sunday school days, even at that particular time, I was wandering far and far from God, and I was playing hard and working hard, which is a silly thing to do in police rescue. That was a bit of a philosophy or culture at that time. We worked hard, we were elitist, we were very, very well trained and relied upon, and so we thought often we deserved to be self-gratified, which is stupid at the time. But I thought, that's interesting that often in life, in my life, and I'm sure everybody that's listening, there's times when we don't know what's happening in our lives. Something's happened in the past, or something might be happening right now, or you're afraid of the future and it challenges you. It might be financial, could be health, you know, it could be well-being, it could be relationships, and a whole range of things might be challenging us right now. And we might say, what's God doing or going to do about this? It's all right to say, I don't know, but God knows. And often there's something that are totally mysterious to us, and we don't know what God's doing or why he's doing it, or the timing. We can't appreciate God's timing. But as I said to Debbie, I said, only God knows. Now, that's so comforting, because if he knows, I often do a throw-off line and say, the God that I know is a know-all. And because he does know it all, and he's not a crisis manager at all. God's a very strategic planner. He knows from the beginning of time to the end of time, through eternity, he knows. He's all-knowing. And so I said to Debbie, only God knows. Well, we got her out, as I mentioned, and got her urgently to hospital. She was in theatres for hours on end with all these specialists coming in to do surgery on her body. They couldn't save a leg. It was beyond saving. So they had to amputate that. And she had a tracheotomy to help her to breathe at one stage. She had a brain injury and lots of other, you know, crush injuries and muscle compartment syndrome, which is where when the muscles get squashed sometimes, they're in this compartment, in this sort of plastic bag, for want of a better expression. Then they sometimes, if there's bleeding inside, they swell and swell and can occlude, actually block the blood supply to the muscle or other parts of the limb. So they have to cut open the compartment to release the pressure. So she's had all of this and survived it. Well, the next day, we got everyone out who was alive. Brian Gordon, sadly, the last man out, passed away some days later in hospital due to his horrific injuries, crushed from literally the umbilicus, that is the belly button down. Yeah. But so just coming back a little bit, the next day, when we got out from under the bridge, we were pretty tired. We'd been there 10 hours working in this confined space. And we went into one of the damaged carriages at the end, and all of us in police rescue went to sleep. We were so tired. We didn't want to eat or drink or anything. We just want to sleep. And so overnight, we slept in this damaged carriage overnight on the seats, right next to a jackhammer breaking up the bridge, which was on top of the train next door to us. It was going the hammers and so breaking up the bridge. And they lifted the portions of the bridge off, put them on semi-trailers for forensic examination at a particular place. Well, next morning, up we got, and the bridge had been removed from the train. So we cut the roof of the train, the crushed roof, and which exposed all of those people who had lost their lives. In the end, there was 80 died there at the scene, and 83 died later in hospital. So there was a death toll of 83. Then the team and I had to then remove all of those dear souls who lost their lives, remove their bodies. We put them on the camera stretchers. And we'd set up a morgue tent next door to the site. It's a big army marquee, which we had, and we took the bodies in there for forensic examination. And just to complete it, we left there and left the scene, and we continued to do rescues. You know, no one says to police rescue, oh, look, you're going to have a rest for a week now. No, the calls kept coming in for police rescue, and off we'd go. Might be a road crash or a climber trapped on a ledge or whatever. Someone lost in the scrub or someone drowned. So we continued to do rescue. About 2 years after Granville, the commissioner of police rang the rescue squad and told me to get onto a TV show called Where Are They Now? No one told me what it was all about. I got ordered to go there. And so it was run by Peter Luck, who was the compere. And so I went on television And I was in the green room, which is like a little room at the side of the studio where they give you a cup of tea and a biggie to calm you down and get you ready to go on camera. So I walked in the studio and all of a sudden the audience were clapping and yelling out, you know, good on you, Gary. And Peter Lux said, ladies and gentlemen, Gary Raymond, one of the heroes of the Granville train disaster. Well, then I thought, oh, that's what it's all about. And next minute, out of the there were very bright lights in the studio, quite warm but very bright, and I could hardly see the audience because the lights were shining at me and Peter Luck. And here comes this lady, this beautiful, tall, blondie, brown eyes, on a walking frame, just, you know, staggering a little bit, but a huge smile on her face, and I recognised straight away it was Debbie Woodgate. And as she came up to me, we cuddled and just cried together, and she whispered in my ear, thank you for saving my life. And I whispered back, it was worth it. Now, as we were sort of composing ourselves and just, I guess, catching up a little bit on right there, I was aware, you know how sometimes when you're in a room and someone walks in behind you, and you're aware that someone's walked in, you turn to see who they are and what they want.
Yep.
I was aware that someone was behind me, and I turned around, and there was a young lady holding a baby. And this young lady handed this baby straight to me. And I was holding this baby like a vice-like grip. I thought, goodness, don't drop a little baby on national television. That'll go down well with the commissioner. So I'm hanging on to this dear little baby, and Debbie said to me, now remember I said to her under that slab, only God knows?
Yes.
She turned around, she said, pointed into the audience, said, Gary, that's my husband Steve, and this is my daughter Shelby. And you know what she said then? She said, Gary, God knew. And I'll tell you what's interesting about that, Vince, is that often in hindsight, we see where God's worked in our life. In the present, we might not see it, might not realise it, but down the track, like Debbie and like myself, when you look back, you can see where God works. So it went from only God knows to God knew. And I want to confirm with people today, not only that God knows, but then down the track, when you get through whatever difficulty you have in your life at the moment, you'll be saying to God knew.
Have you seen her since?
Absolutely. We get together with Steve and Shelby on a regular basis. She only lives about 5 minutes from me.
Right.
Not far at all, yeah. So we're in the western suburbs of Sydney, and she's out there too, not far away, and before the coronavirus emergency, we get together on a regular basis and have dinner together and just share. And it's interesting too that she's come into a very strong commitment to Christ with her husband Steve, and we share the Lord, we share our experiences. And I'll tell you a very interesting one too, Steve. I mentioned Erica Watson, the ballerina, was trapped, and her legs were absolutely crushed. Just think about this. Here's a ballerina who was heading for a career in the ballet, a full-time career. She was so good. And here she was trapped in this confined, dirty space with her legs multiply fractured. We got her out and got her rushed to hospital. And it was a couple of years later, I was at the rescue squad, and Erica, the ballerina, rang. And she said, oh, is that Gary? I said, yeah, she's Erica here. And I said, Erica, how are you going? How have you been going? You recovered all right? And she said, yes, I'm dancing again.
Wow.
And I stopped. And I was very, very, I thought, oh, yeah, so we've got a mental health problem here. We've got a delusional young lady who's fantasizing. And I said, and I kept stoic. I said, oh, that's great. You're dancing again. And whereabouts are you dancing? And she said, Gary, I'm dancing in my heart. And I said, why? And she said, because I found the Lord Jesus as my Saviour, and I'm dancing in my heart. I'm so full of joy that my sins are forgiven, and he's brought me through a horrific disaster where I could have and should have been killed. And I said, oh, isn't that beautiful? When did that happen? And she said, oh, it was on the 29th of November, 1979. That was two years after Granville. You know what, Vince? I nearly dropped the phone and fell off the chair.
Yeah.
I said, Erica, the 29th of November, 1979 was the same day, that evening, I surrendered to Jesus and gave my heart to him and thanked him for forgiving me and to getting me through all sorts of catastrophes the same day. Separate places and circumstances. Isn't God amazing? I mean, here
That's
we
incredible.
Are.
Incredible.
Rescuer and victim in the same place at the same time where our lives, both of us really, when you think about it, were under threat. Because if that bridge had really slipped down, even after they cribbed it, and you know, we would have been killed. And there we were on the same day, God the Holy Spirit and Jesus' love and forgiveness touched our hearts and we surrendered to him.
That's wonderful, Gary. Thank you so much for sharing with us today. I've been speaking to retired Chief Inspector Gary Raymond, and please join us again for our next podcast. Thank you.